In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, a conversation with Ambassador James Jeffrey, former special envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, and Wilson Center Middle East Program Chair. We discuss the Israeli-Hamas conflict and geopolitical fallout. Then Aaron Mehta, editor-in-chief of Breaking Defense, on the military support the U.S. is providing Israel in these early days of the conflict, and what more could be needed. Plus, PBS Frontline director and correspondent James Jacoby discusses his latest documentary, Elon Musk's Twitter Takeover.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Now, Ambassador James Jeffrey, former special envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS and Wilson Center Middle East Program Chair, gives his take on the growing war between Israel and Hamas. We started by asking what makes this conflict different.
I've seen many conflicts not like this, because in the Middle East, you have these fights, conflicts, bombing campaigns and such. We've done them, Israel, other countries, but they usually return to the status quo ante. Only a few times do you see really big ones. The Yom Kippur War against Israel 50 years ago, 9/11, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. This is one of the big ones because it puts Israel's existence at stake. It cannot deal with a Hamas that is capable of attacking much of the population of Israel at the same time as facing Hezbollah in the north over the Lebanese border, Syria, and most importantly, Iran. That's why Israel feels it has to act.
How does U.S. response then, what you've seen over the last couple of weeks, particularly from the White House, rate that, and how do you see what do you see coming from that?
That's been an A-plus so far. President Biden is personally and emotionally committed to Israel, and he is very, very shocked, as is, we saw yesterday, Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, by what happened in Israel, including to a good number of American citizens. And their support diplomatically is, again, 100%. More importantly, they have deployed forces, including two aircraft carriers, to deter Lebanese Hezbollah or their patrons, the Iranians, from intervening against Israel, which would create a two- or three-front war and, again, put Israel in existential threat.
We heard the defense secretary say when it comes to that aid, that munitions and other aid, that it was going over without conditions. Was that the right approach?
That was the right approach. There are always legal conditions, particularly human rights considerations with military equipment that we give other countries. We're also concerned about it being transferred to others. But the Israelis know these rules. If any country has gotten a lot of military aid from us, it's Israel. And I'm sure that they will act in accordance. The main question is the aid is moving very, very rapidly and surprising for us, unbureaucratically. But the Israelis need it now, not tomorrow.
One of the headlines from this morning is Israel asking those in Gaza, 1.1 million, I think the number is, to remove themselves in light of what they what plans come next. What do you think about the request, and is that a reasonable request?
It is certainly a necessary request because Israel is planning on going into the northern, highly built-up urban areas of Gaza to take down Hamas, and there's some 1 million-plus civilians there. What Israel is saying is move some, to give you viewers an idea, 10 miles to the south, and stay there. That puts them closer to the crossing, the Rafah crossing into Egypt, where assistance is still flowing and a lot more could be. This takes more time than the Israelis have given them. It requires more organization. But most importantly, and we haven't seen that yet, it requires Hamas, which is the governing entity, to allow those people to go. For Hamas, these million civilians are nothing more than shields behind which it can continue to attack Israel. And that's the major problem right now.
Ambassador, if this turns into a ground war, what does it mean not only for Israel's sake, but what does it also mean for the United States and its support?
Well, it will turn into a ground war. The first question is how, because militarily Israel has the capability, if it's willing to take heavy casualties, and it, I believe it is, it can militarily conquer the northern half of Gaza and all but destroy Hamas. The problem is this will lead first to civilian casualties and a great deal of pressure on both Israel and from Arab states on the United States to halt the fighting. Israel has halted fighting before on our requested demand. This time it's different. As I said, Israelis see this as existential. The second problem, again, is outside forces coming in. Lebanese Hezbollah, which is up till now basically behaved within the rules, minor shelling back and forth, has said that it will intervene if Israel goes in on the ground. I don't think so, but I could be wrong, because Israel has deployed hundreds of thousands of troops to the Lebanese border, and they're now backed up by the U.S. Navy and Air Force.
And so does it change as far as adding U.S. military forces directly to the fight, or support for those forces if they turn into a ground war? Where do you think that lies?
We are not going to put ground forces in. I would recommend to underline our commitment that we deploy, as we did in 1991 during the Gulf War, Patriot air defense batteries to Israel. They have a lot of them, but they need probably more. Most importantly, if Israel's enemies see that American troops, however few in number, are on the ground, they will get the point that America is in this fight and they should stay out of it.
Do you see a point where the Biden administration, initially they're showing their strong support for what's going on in Israel, but eventually them turning to Israel, asking them to pull back, and whether it be in shelling or direct fighting or anything else?
I am sure that will happen. We saw a preview of that with Tony Blinken in speaking with Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday, where he went on at some length about Israel adhering to international law. The Israelis do adhere to international law, but there's a lot of debate and a degree of vagueness about when you're fighting in built-up areas. We've had the same problem. What's legal and what's not legal? This morning, argument over white phosphorus shells, for example. And in 2006, when Israel went into Lebanon, the Bush administration at the time did pull the plug on the Israeli operation.
That was Ambassador James Jeffrey, former special envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. And he chairs the Wilson Center's Middle East program. Next, we speak to Breaking Defense Editor-in-Chief Aaron Mehta about what kind of support the U.S. military is providing the Israeli Defense Forces right now and what could be needed in the future.
There's an initial tranche of U.S. military support that's headed to Israel. There is some things that have already arrived, in fact. Can you walk us through what those things are?
Yeah, the biggest thing that Israel first asked for, and the U.S. has been kicking their way already, is Iron Dome interceptors. Iron Dome is Israel's missile defense system, primarily aimed towards things like rockets, which obviously we've seen Hamas using significantly over the last couple of weeks. Iron Dome has a pretty high success rate. It's considered really the gold standard for this kind of interceptor.
So explain Iron Dome, how it works.
Sure.
Is this an American system or is it an Israeli system?
It's an Israeli-made system, but with American funding. A lot of what Israel's air defense network has, and there's different layers to this, was co-funded by the U.S. And the U.S., in turn, has taken some of the technology back, put that into our own military. So the system is linked throughout kind of different networking tools into different radars and sensors. It's primarily for intercepting smaller weapons. Israel has different, again, layers for higher-level ballistic missile interceptors, things like this. But so Iron Dome is the kind of go-to system for if a rocket gets launched, an interceptor, an actual physical missile itself, is launched from an Iron Dome system. They intersect in the sky, ideally, and that rocket then is taken out and everyone's safe.
And you said it's been performing well, but it's not 100%.
It's not 100%. And what we've seen from Hamas, certainly on Saturday when the attack happened, but ever since then, is waves of hundreds or even thousands of rockets launched at once. And the idea there is you try to scramble the sensors, you just create too many rockets coming in for the interceptors to safely take out, and things get through. Again, Iron Dome has a very, very high success rate, but things always can get through. And the more rockets that are launched this way, the harder it is to take them all out. That's just a basic rule of missile defense, is that you can only take out so many things if there's a wave coming in.
There's been a carrier strike group that has been sent and stationed into the Mediterranean. This is the USS Gerald Ford. What is a carrier strike group comprised of? So what is out there and what are its capabilities besides deterrence?
Yeah, so it's the carrier itself, as you'd expect, and there's five other ships that have different capabilities. One of those is missile defense capabilities. And the reason they kind of operate together as a whole group is because you want to protect your carrier. So that's kind of what they're geared towards, protecting, assisting, supplying the carrier. Obviously, it also has quite a number of aircraft on the carrier itself. But at the end of the day, you know, the goal first off with sending the carrier strike group was, we're going to message the region that, you know, we are here. A message to Iran, don't do anything. Stay quiet. Message to Israel, we have your back. But there's other aspects that are at play here as well, including things such as gathering signals intelligence. Carrier strike groups have a lot of intelligence gathering capabilities. The ability to potentially resupply Israel if needed. The carrier has a lot of weapons on its munitions in its storage group. You could just take a helicopter, fly it over to Israel if needed. So there's a number of different things that it brings on a tactical level, as well as this posture saying, hey, we are here, we're watching, and we are ready to aid Israel if needed, a message that's being sent to everyone in the region to say, let's try to keep this as isolated as possible.
There have been rumors that a second carrier group could be headed to the region. What are you hearing about that?
Yeah, so it is going to head towards the region, but that was a planned deployment for several months, actually. That's been on the schedule for a while. The question is how long it ends up staying in the region, how long the Ford ends up staying in the region. And, you know, that's something we're going to see in the next couple of weeks. I think I would expect the Ford to stay for a while, given that that has been put forth by the administration as this is our posture, this is our messaging tool. I expect they're going to want to keep that there for a while. What that looks like, I think, is going to depend on what the next couple of weeks bring.
It looks like Israel is getting ready for a ground war in Gaza, and the president has promised unwavering support for Israel. What could that mean as far as military support for Israel?
I think you're going to see, well, two things. One is it's been reported that there are some special operations advisors on the ground in Israel from the U.S. That's most likely because there are reports, as the White House confirmed, of U.S. citizens having been taken as hostages. It seems unlikely that those special operations forces will involve actual operations. It seems like you'd see American SOF going in and conducting operations, but acting as advisors and monitoring the situation, I think that's already happening. I think we'll continue to see that. In terms of materiel, I think it's going to be munitions. It's going to be the Iron Dome interceptors, as we discussed, because that's a system that constantly needs to be replenished. It's going to be the weapons, the precision-guided munitions that are used in these airstrikes that we're seeing across Gaza already. And then we're going to have to see how this ground war, if it happens, how it goes. You know, Israel has pretty consistently across multiple presidential administrations, the Prime Minister Shield there, avoided going into Gaza in full scale. The strategy was we can contain it. We'll use technology to monitor it. We'll do airstrikes and targeted attacks as needed. But we're not going to go full in because I think everyone agrees it's going to be just horrific. The fighting will be horrific. The civilian casualties will be horrific. And it's something that everyone's worked hard to just not have to go down that path. I think the politics in Israel in the wake of this attack and the emotion in the wake of the attack does seem to lend itself towards this being an all-out assault in Gaza in a way that we haven't seen in many years. And I think the U.S. is going to be monitoring that very closely. We have seen some mentions and signaling from the U.S. saying that they expect Israel as a nation state to conduct itself appropriately and to try to avoid civilian casualties. How much pressure the U.S. can put on Israel in that regard in a situation like this remains to be seen.
Do we have all those weapons, given the amount of aid that we've already sent to Ukraine, that we're still planning to send to Ukraine? Do we have ammunition? to send to Israel?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's one that I think is certainly being asked on the Hill right now. Look, the U.S. has been very open about, as have many of our allies and partners, that as we're sending aid to Ukraine, munitions to Ukraine, that our stockpiles are taking a hit as a result. Production is not keeping up. We've had to increase production. The question is, are these the same weapons that Israel would need? There are different types of munitions, obviously, for different systems. Israel's munitions are probably more advanced than the ones that we're sending to Ukraine, frankly. A lot of what we're sending to Ukraine are 155 shells, kind of more basic artillery. Israel has much more advanced weapons, precision-guided munitions off of F-16, something that Ukraine doesn't have yet. So it doesn't need to be a situation where we have to take a decision of supporting Ukraine or supporting Israel overall. I think obviously there will be some overlap, and how that gets handled is going to be a question that the Pentagon's have to figure out, the Biden administration's going to have to figure out, and then sell to Congress and the American people to keep doing it.
That was Aaron Mehta, editor-in-chief of Breaking Defense. Next, conversation with James Jacoby, director and correspondent for PBS's Frontline, about his latest documentary, Elon Musk's Twitter Takeover.
Mr. Jacoby, why did you decide to do a documentary about Elon Musk and the Twitter takeover?
I wanted to make a film and do some reporting about Musk for a long time, and kind of his purchase of Twitter just seemed to be the right time to do it, in terms of the fact that he's sort of been evolving politically over the past couple of years, basically during the pandemic and onward. And it seems like this interesting new chapter in his career, his life, his politics. And it also gave us the chance to do some serious reporting and tell the stories of people that had been working at Twitter, which had been changing in this kind of post-pandemic period as well. So it was just an opportunity to really delve into an interesting strain of politics in America, and also just kind of this latest chapter in Musk's expanding power. I mean, he'd been in, you know, hard tech in terms of, you know, rockets and Tesla and satellite technology. And here is a move into social media and to media itself, which is an odd move and a different move, and much more about kind of affecting the political conversation and the media, and promoting his own voice to some extent and his own views on things, specifically free speech in America and abroad. And it just seemed like a good opportunity to delve into Musk's story and also tell the story of what's been happening at Twitter.
What did you learn about Elon Musk?
A lot. I mean, he... He's an extraordinary innovator, and he also is one of the most popular figures, even political figures, in America right now. And so I have a lot of respect and reverence for what he's been able to accomplish with Tesla, with SpaceX, with Starlink, and a lot of other things. And, you know, I think that what happened that was interesting was that... You know, he'd always been active on Twitter. He's always said he loved Twitter. He joined it in 2010, 2011, around there, and he has tweeted, you know, thousands and thousands of times about his observations on the world and about everything from books to technology to theories about things. But he really was kind of steered clear of politics on Twitter for a long time. But then you see that when the pandemic hit and Tesla factories were closed during the lockdowns, and he got sort of politically activated during the pandemic period, as a lot of people did in this country. And that learning about his sort of political evolution and his, you know, feelings on free speech in America and abroad was fascinating. And I mean, we can get into it, but there was a lot learned here.
Yeah, I just want to show one clip from your documentary. This is where you looked at Elon Musk and how he used this platform, Twitter, before he purchased the company.
Launch direct on countdown one. SpaceX, Falcon Heavy, go for launch.
10, 9, 8.
Side booster ignition.
6.
It had all the elements of a perfect day for Elon Musk.
2.
A test launch of his latest reusable rocket, the most powerful in the world, capable of deep space exploration. It was a crucial step toward his ultimate goal, the conquest of Mars.
Elon Musk, I think, gets his most pleasure out of rocket ships. And at moments when the rockets go off, that's when the childish pleasure comes out. He doesn't usually like having pleasure. He doesn't savor the moment, but he does when it's a rocket launch.
Camera views from inside the payload fairing, hashtag Falcon Heavy.
Throughout the day, Musk provided running commentary at his favorite place to express himself, the social media site Twitter.
Upper stage restart nominal, apogee raised to 7,000 kilometers.
He's a performer. He likes it. He likes it. He likes playing Elon Musk. I swear, he thinks he's Iron Man.
Right on cue, Musk's rocket discharged his own cherry red Tesla, complete with a mannequin in the driver's seat.
Elon Musk has outdone himself this time.
Normally, for a new rocket, you know, they'd launch like a block of concrete. I mean, that's so boring. That's still tripping me out. I mean, I'm tripping balls here.
The electric car and the reusable rocket were part of a vast business empire. From neurotechnology to artificial intelligence to a web of satellites encircling the Earth, that has made Elon Musk one of the richest and most powerful men in the world.
View from SpaceX launch control. Apparently, there is a car in orbit around Earth.
And the app he was using to live tweet the launch, a few years later, that would be his too.
Elon Musk puts in an offer to buy Twitter.
Elon Musk and Twitter announced a $44 billion deal today.
He says he wants to transform the company.
James Jacoby, you also mentioned in this documentary more openly about Elon Musk using Twitter for marketing before he purchased the company for Tesla, for SpaceX. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating. I mean, Tesla doesn't do really any marketing. And in fact, in some of their filings to the SEC and elsewhere, they kind of have mentioned over the years that it, in part because Musk is such a public personality, in many ways his conduit is Twitter, they don't really need to do any major advertising. And so Twitter, you know, we wanted to kind of tell the story in part as sort of Musk's love affair with Twitter to some extent. I mean, he has used Twitter to express himself. He often makes the joke that people use their hair to express himself. I don't, clearly, but some people may, and he uses Twitter to express himself. And Walter Isaacson has spent the past couple of years with Musk as his biographer, refers to it as sort of Twitter being this kind of global playground, and that Musk loved, you know, he was bullied as a kid, he was beaten up as a kid growing up in South Africa at a rough time, and that in some ways, you know, Twitter, which is sort of a rough and tumble free speech, you know, opinionator environment that Musk was really good at and gained a lot of followers on it, and that he was good at Twitter and gained a huge following, has, you know, more than 100 million followers now, and has used it to make jokes. He's used it to go after some critics of his. But, you know, in the years before his takeover, it was a major marketing tool for him. And it was a major way for him to kind of create this cult of personality and engender this audience that really liked the fact that he was unfiltered and that he was honest about his opinions and said some controversial things, made some funny jokes, some off-color jokes and things like that. And I think people really appreciated that. And it appealed to, you know, clearly hundreds of millions of people. And it was also in some ways fascinating to see how he used Twitter and also how former President Trump used Twitter, who obviously used Twitter before he was president as a way to promote himself and his brands, The Apprentice and other things he was doing, and was very savvy at how to do things succinctly, cleverly on the medium. And Musk, you know, whether Musk was using that Trump playbook or vice versa, but they both really kind of mastered the art of Twitter. And we really try to tell a little bit of that evolution at the beginning of the film.
Now that he has bought the company, is it the same effective tool for him?
Yeah, if not more so. He's experimented at various points with how amplified he may be on the platform. We get into a strange chapter in that story in the film. But I think that this is certainly an effective tool now that he owns the platform to promote himself, his views, and people that he sees as like-minded. I think he also wants to bring people that are not like-minded onto the platform, but it generally appears to be that he's interested in kind of promoting his views and similar people with similar viewpoints to him.
That was James Jacoby, director and correspondent for the new PBS Frontline documentary, Elon Musk's Twitter Takeover.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Journal podcast. We want to make sure you know about our latest podcast, Books That Shaped America. It's a companion podcast to our 10-week television series of the same name. We've teamed up with the Library of Congress and selected 10 books from across American history that have had a major impact on our society. Each week, the C-SPAN television program will focus on one of these books and its impact. This companion podcast will give you more background on the book's authors. If you want to learn more about Books That Shaped America, go to our website, c-span.org. The podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts.